Welcome, everyone, to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence, coming to you from New York City. We talk to Charlottesville citizens who are most impacted by the latest scratch-your-head federal policies and bring you the most interesting guests we can find. On this program, we're going to give away a Cardinal Hall gift certificate for $25. We'll ask a question based on today's conversation somewhere near the end of the program. We'll ask you that question, and then you'll message us from the Facebook page of 94.7. That's at 94.7 WPVC, so listen carefully for a question about today's conversation. Here on Apropos of Something, we're grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are lucky enough to have some great guests. We're talking with Feza Burak Adli on Islam and feminism, and we're talking to world water expert Dr. Peter Debarre. But first, Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here, and those do sound like great guests.
Thank you.
But, oh, you're welcome. But I do want to warn you that I have a new tenant now living above me, and all I know of them is I think they have bowling balls and hard-soled shoes. So I don't know their Saturday morning habits. I'm hoping they're still sleeping for the next hour.
So that's a warning to us.
The audio I may be, the additional audio I may be bringing to this conversation.
I do remember that about being in New York City. There were a lot of neighbor issues.
That's very diplomatic of you. Yes. It does make me now forever want to live on the top floor or a desert island or under a rock, which, as you know, will always be my preference.
Right.
Except between 10 and 11
That's
on Saturdays,
right,
when we have great guests to talk with.
On 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, I might add.
Please do. So I'll tell you my very briefly, my very innocent fantasy for Mr. Trump, if I may. It's very,
yes,
very brief.
Please.
I would just, like, even if it has to be as complex as a Mission Impossible mission, I would love for someone just to pin on the back of his suit, his Trump suit, impeach me. You know, kick me, please. Just the impeach me, please. Just if I could just get a photo of him walking down the hall of the West Wing or something with impeach me, please,
just
unknowingly.
Whatever would do it today. I mean, this week I was really struck with, let's just try to, I don't know how to say this diplomatically on the air, but could we please just not have him anymore? And I don't even want to debate the policies anymore. It's just get rid of the problem. We can debate if you would like, but I was just really traumatized. You know, I go through cycles of I'm super traumatized, and then I think I take a breather. I don't look at world events, and then I come back, and then I'm, like, re-traumatized. And
it is exhausting.
Yeah.
I will give you that, obviously. Yes, okay. So now you got me speechless. Okay.
Well,
not that I had any more. I just
have a couple of events, because what's helped me is to be on this radio station, quite honestly, and to be active and to try to do whatever I can do to help the situation. And so I wanted to announce a couple of things going on in this town. There's going to be a screening of short films on March 23rd. That's a Thursday. They're films on refugees by young local filmmakers from Lighthouse at the Bridge Arts Initiative. For more information, go at the Bridge PAI on Facebook. And then also a couple of weeks ago, we spoke with the local organization helping Latinos here called Sin Barreras, and they're looking for volunteers with some experience doing publicity for nonprofits. They could use some help getting the word out for their organization. Contact them at Sin Barreras Civil. We do have an interesting show today. I might want to get started with that.
Yeah, I think you should.
Okay, so our first guest is Feza Burak Adli. She came to the U.S. from Turkey in 2004. She is an expert on Islamic feminism and is working on her Ph.D. in anthropology at Boston University. Feza lives in Charlottesville and is teaching courses at UVA on Islam, feminism, and nationalism in the Middle East. Welcome, Feza.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. I mean, what a great show to be on, and I really appreciate what you guys are doing here. It's really important.
Well, thank you. That means a lot.
Yes. Yeah, so, we haven't even asked you a question yet. We can't complain. I'm sorry. Please.
No. So I wanted to ask you, what were the immediate effects you noticed right after the election?
Well, let me just start talking about the initial trauma that, you know, I experienced and witnessed here. So right after the election night, I went to campus, you know, UVA campus where I teach. And what I saw was appalling. The level of fear, the frustration, and all those really strong feelings were not some sort of disappointment, you know, after the outcome of the election. It was more like apocryphal fear, right? The end is near almost. And I'm not even exaggerating. My colleagues in women and gender studies were crying. Mm. My minority students were crying. Everyone was worried, sick about what's going to happen to them, right? And I wanted to tell them that, you know, everything's going to be all right. You know, I wanted to call them, calm them down. But hate crimes had already started. And at this point, someone on campus actually wrote a sign, terrorist, on the door of a dorm room that belonged to a former student of mine. She's a veiled Muslim student and a brilliant young lady. But that was so heartbreaking, mm-hmm. to have hate crimes on campus committed by another fellow college kid. We are talking about kids here, right?
Right. And a prestigious campus and a place that some of us don't think of as, how could that happen here? We might think of it that way.
Exactly. And the parents especially, they start, you know, worried about the safety of their kids, as you said, on the campus of UVA, and the place that you'll least expect it to be.
But have you heard from, have you heard from, I know you're a teacher as opposed to a counselor, but have parents, you know, in any way, are parents asking how to safeguard their kids? I realize it's college and not, you know, younger, but has that happened?
Well, I didn't directly talk to any parents, but my students, especially my Muslim students, reported me that some of their parents actually requested from them to unveil, to take their hijab off for the, you know, fear of security and safety. And, I mean, we are living in 21st century America and talking about freedom of religion and everything. And now the parents themselves, you know, they're asking their kids to take the veil off because they don't feel safe anymore. And I don't feel safe anymore, too.
Mm. And so I learned in talking to you earlier that veiled, unveiled really means a hijab or a head covering. Mm-hmm. So when I thought of veiled, I thought of it in a different way. So just when we're talking about that, it just means hijab.
Well, it just means hijab, like covering off your hair and your neck sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Dressing in a more modest way, let's put it that way. And
okay.
There are varieties of way to veil. You know, there's a huge spectrum of how women have been veiling around the world. So there's no one single, you know, formula or a shape of it.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. So yeah, I mean, go
going
on.
Back with the initial trauma, you know, hate crimes. I mean, Islamophobia is nothing new to Trump. He didn't start it. But the thing is, as the president of the United States, he legitimized and empowered the bigots who felt validated enough to start burning down the mosques. And let's see what he's looking here, what he's doing here, right? So he is basically what I call boxing and labeling. So he's creating a box and then putting 1.6 million Muslims in the same box as if they are a single, monolithic, homogeneous group. And then the next step is to label the box, right? And he is labeling it as Muslims, a.k.a. dangerous peoples, radicals, potential threats, terrorists. I mean, look at the symbolic violence here. And as a social scientist and an expert on the Middle East politics, I know one thing or two about authoritarianism, okay? This is the first rule in the playbook of authoritarians. What they do is, the first thing they do is to create a new regime of truth, okay? And they dismiss the reality, the facts, as fake news, as we are experiencing here. And
that's so interesting because to us, oh, this is such a new thing. But as
it's not a new
in the world.
It's centuries-old authoritarian, you know, playbook. They, first of all, you know, they create an enemy, external or internal. I mean, even better, both, right? And then when you create that enemy, find some scapegoats to, you know, show as a potential threat, and then spread the fear around the country. And then there you go. You know, you conveniently created the condition for your own rule and a fake need for strong men to protect people to protect national sovereignty under attack, and that's fake attack, right? And so Islamophobia or this kind of creating new threats by
has
the
it affect, yeah. I'm just wondering, has it affected wherever it is that you worship, has it affected your routine of worship, or has your place of worship made any changes to protect its members?
So the members of the mosque here in Charlottesville, of course, they felt, you know, they were worried about what's going to happen if there will be any hate crimes. But from what I'm hearing is that actually there has been an unprecedented level of outreach to mosque. That's the silver lining of Trump's administration. People are reaching out to the mosque and they want to stand by them in solidarity. So, I mean, our mosque did not get burned down or anything, as some others did in Canada and in Texas. But it's, you know, like it is kind of, I mean, you don't feel safe nonetheless, right? Because there is a now space for hate crimers.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are... This is spreading fear, obviously. What are the misconceptions that you about Islam that you find that you would like to contradict?
Oh, that's a great question. Excuse me. I mean, I can answer you as a Muslim, as a practicing Muslim, and also as a social scientist who is studying Islam in a scholarly fashion. I mean, on personal level, you know, Islam is a religion of love and tolerance, and we are required to love everything that's created for the sake of Creator, because we think everything, and not everyone, but every single thing, including plants and animals and non-animate objects, as a reflection of God. So, but let's just put my personal faith and the way I practice Islam, the way I interpret Islam aside, and talk about some social facts, right? So, like any other religion, any other tradition, Islam is diverse. We are talking about 1.6 billion people around the world, and we are talking about a religion 1,400 years old. So there are differences, you know, there are social differences among each Muslim nation state, right? They have different histories, they have different cultures, they have their own political structures, their own economic structures, own social institutions and norms. They also have ethnic differences. I mean, you will see differences between Turks, Arabs, Persians, South Asians, or Central Asians, right? And also, the way they interpret and the way they live Islam also differs, okay? So there's a spectrum of, you know, schools of Islam, let's say. There's not one single way of living and understanding Islam. So let's say a Wahhabi Saudi or a Salafi Egyptian or a Shi'i Iranian, a Sunni Indonesian or a Sufi Turk, their lives are not the same. The way they live, their religion is not the same. So there is this diversity. But I also want to talk about, you know, not only each nation state has their own national heritage, but they also have their own distinct problems, their own conflicts, okay, political struggles. I'm saying this because I don't want to be an apologetic for any sort of atrocities committed in a Muslim land, okay? Because we have, like in any other nation state, European or not, right? Western or Eastern, every nation state has some sort of political conflicts. So, for instance, as you would hear all the time from pundits, from Islamophobes, that Islam oppresses women. Why? Well, look at Saudi Arabia. Women cannot drive there. I mean, can you imagine? No, I cannot imagine. I agree with you, my friend. I mean, this is not...
Actually, Faiza, I'm curious because you are mentioning women, and I am interrupting. I do apologize.
Go ahead.
And I know that from what you're already telling me, there are many answers to this. So given that, what is the role, at least in your sect of the religion, what is the role of women as described in the Muslim religion? Does it all come from the Quran or their oral traditions? What is that? Is there a It seems like there's a role. I guess that's why I'm asking. Mm-hmm. Is there?
So, yeah, it's a great question, but it doesn't have a simple answer. It's a very complex.
I know.
And so what I was going to say about the Saudi women, I was going to say it was not the Islam as religion who was doing the oppression there. It is the Saudi king. It's the political regime, right? So along with that, what I was going to say is that in feminist theory, we have a concept called intersectionality, okay? So we never locate women's issues, women's status, roles of women in a society just in an abstract category of patriarchy versus women. No, we look at, intersections of class status, politics, economy, so many other things that come together. So the role of a woman in Islam, first of all, to be a believer, and in that sense, in the Quran, whenever God is addressing human beings, he starts saying all women and men. So he is giving equal responsibility to the believers. But I'm not a theologian, so I'm not here to really talk about the verses in the sacred text. But you said something very important, okay? So we have multiple subjectivities everywhere, right? So I'm a Muslim woman, and of course some of the some chunk of my life is informed by Islam and Quran, but it's also informed by the education I received, by the family I come from, by the nation state, my cultural heritage. I mean, so many things kind of determine or shape or inform your role in society, right? I mean, in Turkey we had a female prime minister like in 90s, whereas in Saudi Arabia women cannot drive. You know what I'm saying? So there is no such one recipe for women in Islam to be this or that. And when we look back into the history, it's also been changing. Like the wife of the Prophet Muhammad was a businesswoman, uh-huh. Even in that society.
I'm sorry.
I just want to say, for people who are just tuning in, we are on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and we are talking with Feza Burak Adli, who is an expert in Islam and feminism, and we're getting into some good discussions. We're going to break in about a minute. Right. We still have another time for a question, Nancy.
Okay. Because I know that you are Muslim and a feminist, and I know that's possible because you are in our studio as one. Can you explain how those two, you can be both? Because I'll just end it there. Can you explain how you can be both, how anyone can be both Muslim and a feminist?
Yeah, actually, I keep hearing this, is Islamic feminism an oxymoron?
I didn't say that.
I kept hearing around, right? Even my students who are taking my course, Islam and Feminism, came and told me that, some of their friends asked them, what feminism and Islam are you talking about, right?
So let's come back after the break. We're going to address that question. We have a hard break coming up. Thank you. We're going to address Islam and feminism together in just a moment. We're talking with Feza Burak Adli. She's an expert on Islam and feminism, and we're just posing a question about how those two exist together, and we're going to talk to her about that. And then in a little bit, we're also going to talk to Peter DeBeer, who is a world water expert. So do you want to address that question?
Feminism. Well, first we should start about what Islam and what feminism we're talking about, right? The Western secular liberal feminism is not necessarily a universal feminist movement, okay? Feminism can take different shapes, different contents, different methodologies, specific to their own locale. So going with that, Islamic feminism is a movement that seeks gender equality within the framework of Islam. They reinterpret the sacred texts like Quran and Hadith, and they underline and highlight those verses which is talking about the egalitarianism, ontological egalitarianism of the sexes for both men and women. So Islamic feminists or Muslim feminists, they are fighting against, one, the patriarchal culture that is not necessarily abiding by religion, right? So they are saying religion has given me all my rights, my human rights, and I am as equal as to you on all those rights. But you are not following your religion. So, and secondly, they're also critiquing some of the male clerics, right? So since Islam can be interpreted in different ways as a like in on the other religions. There are some of these Sunni schools of thought was codified in 9th century Abbasi period in an Arab society, and the male clerics back then they brought their own conceptions of society and social structure into their interpretations of the text, as we all do, right? We always read text through our own lenses. So today, Islamic feminists are saying those male clerics were operating in a misogynistic society, so they came up with some sort of formulas for social justice, but those formulas do not apply anymore. Social justice means something else today. You know, in 9th century, it meant a patriarchal benevolence, right? The patriarchy being benevolent and generous and protective of the woman and supportive of the woman. But today, you know, we are talking about men and women working together and doing in society. They're kind of partners almost in everything now. So social justice means different things. So yes, Islamic feminism does exist, and they do fight against any sorts of gender inequality.
Does a woman need extra courage or any courage at all to, you know, go to college to have a career? Is that also a misconception?
So, for me, probably my family would... I don't want to say renounce me, but they would be really disappointed if I didn't have a college education. And all the women in my family had university degrees, including my own mother. So for us, for many educated Muslims, education is a requirement of the religion, okay? You are supposed to seek knowledge. But then it's not the same everywhere, right? We have some tribal areas, let's say in Pakistan or somewhere else, and the patriarchy of the family would not allow his daughter to go outside. And so that's a problem there. But it's not about, again, some sort of abstract religious idea.
Right. Okay. Gotcha.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're talking to Feza Burak Adli, an expert and a teacher here at UVA on Islam and feminism and nationalism. I had a question. Considering there's so much hatred coming from the very top in this country and focused on Muslims in particular, what do you do with that, and how can we avoid those kinds of prejudice and judgments or what we see around us?
Well, I think there's more than ever, there's a need for dialogue and solidarity. And thank God it is on its way. I mean, I think the only silver lining of Trump administration is the unintended consequence of, you know, he brought people together against bigotry. And it's happening. Let me just give you a couple of examples. So one of the organizers of the Women's March in Washington, D.C. was a veiled Muslim woman, Linda Sarsour. Right. And the same woman also initiated a campaign, and Muslims raised like $100,000 overnight to rebuild the vandalized Jewish cemetery in St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes.
So people are coming together and helping each other against all sorts of bigotry. But let me also talk to you about what I experienced after the Muslim ban, right? So when I first heard about, you know, when they announced the Muslim ban on TV, I mean, I cannot tell you the level of disappointment I had. I was like, 21st century America, which is supposed to be the beacon of liberal democracy, and this is happening here. And I was so exhausted. I felt burned out, and I wanted to just, you know, shut down TV and media and internet and just, you know, crawl back inside and isolate myself in my studies. I lacked the energy to speak up at that moment. But what happened next gave me so much hope, because American people happened, you know, after Trump, American people happened. So first people took over airports and then the streets for days and nights in solidarity with Muslims, right? And then Charlottesville Mayor Mike Singer also organized a protest event, and he declared Charlottesville as the city of capital of resistance. And then groups like Indivisible Charlottesville happened. They organized so many great events. And UVA students, faculty and staff also, you know, had their own protests. So we were not alone. I was not alone. And let me tell just one little story that's really heartwarming. So on Valentine's Day, around like 8 p.m., our doorbell rang. And we were not expecting anyone. So we were kind of, you know, surprised. And there she was. There was a beautiful, elegant lady I think, in her 60s, and she was holding a beautifully decorated, like hand-decorated box of handmade cupcakes. She baked cupcakes, right? And then she was there, "Hi, my name is Rosie. I live across the street. And since today is the Valentine's Day, I want to take this as an opportunity to reach out to my Muslim neighbors." And so she then said, "I am here tonight to apologize for my president."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, oh my God! Like, yeah. That was the best Valentine gift ever one can ever, you know, receive.
That's an amazing story, and just these little things just do make a difference.
No, as long as there's a Rosie living next door, Trump can never win. We need more Rosies.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
What we need.
Yeah.
Do you find that the actually, I don't know if you find this. So, do Muslim Americans have to reconcile that they have more freedoms in America than those in the Middle East? Is there?
What do you mean by reconciliation? I think they're aware of that, right? And the thing is, like, it's not like Western. I mean, America, yeah, it is one of the free places in the world. But there are so many other Muslim majority countries. People live. I mean,
I'm
in
only
freedom. It's not like
America,
you know,
because that's where we are. That's why I realize there are other places.
I would, if you ask it to a Turkish person or a Indonesian person, or I don't know, like in some countries, they are perfectly happy living in there because they don't talk about these kind of, you know, freedom issues. Whereas, I mean, if you ask an Iranian who's forced to wear a veil or hijab or something like that, of course it's it's an issue. So again, it depends on which country we are talking about, okay? And
okay.
As you can imagine right now in America, believe me, I don't feel free to wear my hijab and practice my religion as I used to, you know, because, I mean, hate crimes. And, I mean, maybe you remember this, but three people in Chapel Hill, North Carolina got killed. And they were just brilliant UNC students who were, like, very active, civically active. They were in dental school, and they just got killed. Why hate crime? I mean, I don't call this as freedom of America anymore, you know?
No, I wasn't implying that we were perfect at all. I just was curious about, you heard my question. I don't mean to repeat it.
Can I just say one more thing,
please,
about, you know, what we should be doing other than the dialogue, you know, like and Rosie is of us, right? So I was also wanted to say one more thing about that. I mean, dialogue is happening, like people are getting together in solidarity. Yes, I got this, and it's wonderful. But I think there is one more thing that we need to be doing here. We should reach out to Trump supporters as well. I mean, we liberals always talk amongst each other, okay? We don't really reach out. And the reason I'm saying this is that, I mean, some of the sources of bigotry or hate or fear is not factual based. I mean, you know, people, it's not like people can fact check stuff, can read stuff, but it's not going to change their hearts, you know, because, I mean, I am afraid of bugs, okay? And it's an irrational fear, I know. And you can tell me that they are harmless, you know, don't be ridiculous. You know, you're an educated woman. I mean, how can you be afraid of bugs? But it is irrational fear, and I cannot help it. And knowledge does not help me. So my therapist actually advised me to hold a bug in my own hands and observe it closer, right, in a closer way, because then I will have an experiential knowledge, right? So I cannot remember the number of people who later confessed me that their perspectives on Muslims have changed after knowing me, right? After we shared so much together, and after we laughed together and cried together, and, you know, shared so much as neighbors or friends. And so I think sometimes people need not discursive knowledge, right? Something
right.
Written, but embodied knowledge, experiential knowledge. Relationships can change hearts.
Yes, let's end on that really great note. Relationships can change hearts. Thank you so much, Feyza Burak Adli from UVA, studying in Boston University on Islam, feminism, and nationalism in the Middle East. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. That was
sure.
A great pleasure.
Yes. So our next guest is Peter DeBeer. He is the Associate Professor of Business Administration at the Darden School at UVA. He is an international economist who is, in recent years, has been researching and teaching the economics of water. So welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, I can almost hear you, Peter. I'm sorry. There you are. There you are. Thank you.
I can't. Peter, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Nancy, if you can hear, then I think we're good.
Yes, I can.
Okay. So I don't know. I just learned that World Water Day is March 22nd, and we've had about 4 World Water Days. Can you tell me about that? What is World Water Day, and what are the events going on? And I hear that you helped plan that event here on campus.
Yeah, and it's a series of events, the World Water events that we've been organizing for the fourth time. So it's a series of talks and panel discussions and activities that focus on water.
Hey, Peter.
Yes?
Could you shift over to the other mic? We're having some technical difficulties. We're going to use the other microphone.
Can you hear me now?
Perfect. So
all right.
I get to ask the question again. what are the World Water events? And go ahead.
Yeah, so it's basically a series of talks and panel discussions and activities that focus on water and in particular water infrastructure here at UVA. They're open to everyone, right? And they start on March 15th with a talk by the Dean of the School of Architecture here at UVA. She'll talk about how cities can integrate water in their architecture and their layout. And then we'll close on April 13th in the Darden Business School with a panel on the aftermath of the Flint water crisis, right? So in focus on water infrastructure, water quality, and social issues, social justice associated with it.
I think that answers my next question, which is why are we doing this? And maybe you could give more a fuller answer. Why are you studying this?
So why are we doing this? Well, I mean, so it's basically the case that we know water is precious, right? So you need water for whatever you do, and there's actually on many places on Earth increasingly more scarcity of water, and there's more competition for water between the major users, right? Agriculture, cities, and the environment. So basically, the challenge is really to manage water more properly, right? So and that's also where infrastructure, water infrastructure, plays a huge role to make sure that everybody has access to safe water and that we treat water properly, so don't dump wastes into our waterways. And so it's the case that when I say we here at UVA, there's economists, there's engineers, there's environmental scientists, there's architects, and increasingly we talk to each other and we actually try to work across disciplines, and actually found also a global water center. And this World Water events are a bit our outreach, right, to make people aware of the challenges that we face with respect to water and what we can do about it.
What are some good or bad? How does water become economic policy? I can't even actually get my head around that. Could you help me?
Yeah. So it's actually not a coincidence, I find, that so increasingly also that economists are thinking about water, right? So basically, if you have a situation which is one that we face in many, many countries and places these days, is that water becomes increasingly scarce. So what does that mean? It means that basically there's no longer this water abundance, so that there's not, it doesn't mean that we're running out of water. It just means that for all the things that we want to do, that we don't have enough water. So we've got to prioritize. We've got to think about how we can use water optimally. And this is very much an economics question, right? So how do you optimally distribute water? How do you use it in the most productive ways, right? So and that's where economics comes in, right? So in I mean, there's also an international dimension to this, and I'm an international economist. And so, for example, if you think about a country such as Saudi Arabia, believe it or not, for some time Saudi Arabia was actually exporting wheat. Now, wheat, and this is true for many agricultural products, use lots of water. Now, Saudi Arabia is a very water-scarce country, right? So this is something that's that's almost incomprehensible that a country that has so little water uses so much water then also to export. So then the issue is that if you care about water scarcity, what you want is that people use it properly, and also from an international perspective, that those countries, those locations that have lots of water, they export those goods that that need lots of water, but not water-scarce countries do that.
So what would you recommend? What are the tools to implement what you would ideally want?
Well, one of the things that's very important is that we actually value the water as a scarce resource, right? So as an economist, that also implies that we price proper water properly, which is oftentimes not done, right? So if it's not hard to see if you make water available for free, right, which is also what's happening in Saudi Arabia and in many countries, actually, the price of water is way too low. So if you make water available at a very low price, then obviously people will use too much of it and will waste it, right? So pricing water is an important element in such a decision.
So we're coming up to a break. We'll be right back with Peter DeBeer. He is the Associate Professor of Business Administration at Darden. He is a world water expert. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you're listening to Apropos of Something. Welcome to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. My name's Ellen Daniels. I'm co-hosting with Nancy Lawrence, coming from New York City. And we're talking with Peter DeBeer. He's a professor at Darden, and he is a world water expert. We were just kind of getting into the economics of water. I had a question, which was, so everyone needs water, it's scarce. How would you go about pricing it? How would you address the issues of desperate need?
Right. I mean, this is a very good question, and it's one that actually always comes up when people mention that there should be a price paid for water. The first thought that often is that people say, and I agree with that, is I say, look, water is a human right. And yes, indeed, and it is. And a few years ago, we had at Darden, we had Peter Brabeck coming, who's the CEO and chairman of Nestle. And what people don't know about him is that he's actually a very strong water advocate on the international scene. And so he was addressing this question about water as a human right. And he said, yes, indeed, it should be the case that water for human needs, the water that you drink, the water that you need for hygiene, that should be very easily available. But it's not the case that water to water your lawn or to wash your car is a human right, right? Especially in a situation of scarcity. So, pricing water doesn't mean that one ignores the human rights aspect to it. And there's actually ways of also in practice dealing with this. This is not 0-1. Think about Singapore. It's probably a country that has the most... it's really at the cutting edge in managing water well, which is basically the main challenge that we face. And what they do is that for people with fewer means, they basically make an allotment of water available, an account that they can use for water, right? So it's you can also price water differently in that the more you use, you can price it higher. So pricing water is essential to guarantee that people don't waste it, that they feel also that they have an incentive to save water, right? If the price of water is high, there's also an incentive for people to start investing in saving water. There will be an incentive to start innovating in conserving water. So yes, we're not going to solve the problems of or the challenges with respect to water if we don't think about valuing water more properly and pricing it as well.
Do you think there's a way to improve corporate social responsibility? Are there incentives or policy in some method to do that?
Yes, I mean, this is indeed it's an important point. And so I actually teach at the Darden Business School, and I teach a class on water, the global economics of water. And what we see is that MBA students are actually quite, and the newest, especially also the newer generation, the younger generation of MBA students are very interested in these issues. And oftentimes, there's a bit of a misunderstanding about business schools, or at least some business schools, is that, yes, in a business school, it is about generating business, making money. But at the same time, you can actually make money by doing the right thing. You can create products that are healthier. You can try to sell fuel-efficient cars. So yes, there's also an avenue for firms to conserve water, to save water, to be proactive in the water sphere, and yes, make profit as well.
Are there nations that you feel are doing a good job or leading the way in how the, in their water sustainability and using their water supply?
So what you see is that especially Singapore is probably leading, right? So and why is that also? It's a country that, even though it's at the equator, and so it basically gets lots of water, the issue is that water is scarce for different reasons. So it's a small island, right? It doesn't, can't really capture so much water. And it was dependent on water from Malaysia. And these contracts through which it received its water from Malaysia are being cancelled. So it feels water is a national security issue. And it basically saves every possible drop of water. It does lots of recycling, right? So it it has a culture that is focused on water education, right? In schools, kids learn about water very much, right? So they also price water, right? They price it at the cost it actually costs to produce it at the margin, while at the same time making it available for those who are less fortunate, right? So obviously, it's a relatively rich country, so it's not the case that all the means and demands that it has can be easily emulated everywhere.
Would you consider yourself an environmentalist?
So, I mean, there's different ways of looking at this. So and if you look at how water has been studied, right, so there's a very strong engineering tradition in the water studies, right, that really looks at the supply of water. Then there's environmental science that look at the water system, the hydrology, right? So in an environment where basically water is increasingly scarce, it's important that engineers, environmental scientists, and economists talk together. So yes, yeah. we share basically similar concerns, right? So water is, I mean, touches everything and is basically a very interdisciplinary subject.
What has been the, in terms of the environment, what do you feel is the impact of the Clean Water Act here?
So one of the challenges with the, I mean, for one, I should say, so the Clean Water Act, when it was came into being in the early 70s, right, really addressed a very important need of cleaning up the act, cleaning up the rivers, because there has been lots of pollution, and the major concern was industrial pollution. Now we are actually quite a bit later, right? And the challenges have changed, right? So industry, to a large extent, has cleaned up its act, right? So, and the Clean Water Act really was fairly strict on them. What actually still is a problem is non point source pollution. So that is pollution, for example, that comes from runoff from agriculture or from through stormwater. And unfortunately, the Clean Water Act has not really regulated this type of pollution. And this is a really big problem. Because, I mean, in my class, Global Water, the Global Economics of Water, sorry. So we sometimes have visitors, and we had George Hawkins from DC Water, right? So it's basically one of the largest, if not the largest, water treatment plant in the world. So it's in DC. So and yes, he was basically saying that, look, at the treatment plants, what they try to do is really increasingly discharge very clean water, right? So it's at that point that this costs lots of money to really make it even cleaner, whereas at the same time, downstream, what you see is that agriculture, that there's runoff from agriculture that basically pollutes the rivers, and that there's really not much invested in that. So it's a very inefficient way of trying to address water pollution. So yes, getting at non-point source pollution is a very important issue.
We're talking
going forward.
Sorry, we're talking with Peter DeBeer. He's a professor at Darden. He's a world water expert. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is apropos of something. I also wanted to say that at the very end of the program, just in a few minutes, actually, we're going to be giving away a gift certificate for Cardinal Hall for $25. And you can win that by, at the very end, I will be asking a question, and then you can go to the Facebook page at 94.7 WPVC, and then message us your answer. So the first person will win that gift certificate. So, Peter, I hear that your class has been transformational for some people, and you've had some visitors. Chris Long, for instance, I became aware that he's doing a lot of work with fellow football players, I believe, in Tanzania. How has your class been transformational? And I heard you might be able to hook us up with him. He might stop by here one day. I'll put you on the spot.
Yeah. So I'm happy to talk to him about that. So yes, why is it the case that my class is often transformational? Is that because it may make you look at the world a little differently? That and at least that's what my students tell me, is that they certainly become aware of that. Water is involved in whatever you do, and we use so much water, right? So, I mean, just if you think about it, to produce a glass of wine, you need 29 gallons of water. If you eat for a pound of steak, it's a couple thousand gallons of water, right? So you use lots of water, right? So, and they were not really aware of this. At the same time, they see that water is a challenge in many spots on the world, and that we actually have tools to address these challenges. So it's not like this important challenge that we face, right? Probably one of the most important ones in the 21st century, is something that we don't have tools to work on. I think that's for MBA students who go into business, right? So, and who increasingly also are responsible and want to change the world for the better, right? This is something important for them.
And just to remind people who want to learn more about this topic, it is World Water. Is it World Water
Events?
Events. I just wanted to get the name right. It's uvaworldwater.org, and we'll also have it on our website as well. But March 15th through April 13th, there are several events, and we'll post that poster, and you can find more about that on our website. Is there a focus that you wanted to talk about, one event that you particularly find interesting or important?
So maybe there's two things that I would like to mention. Is on the one hand, there are these events where there are talks, right, and panel discussions. At the other hand, we also have more hands-on activities, right? There is a trek around Ragged Mountain Reservoir, right, on March 24th, and there's also a water quality testing clinic with Robbie Savage from Rivanna Conservation Alliance. So, but the event that I would focus on is the panel discussion on Flint, right? So 2 years later, right? So we're very fortunate. We have Amy Pruden coming. She was part of the Virginia Tech team that basically assisted Flint when the lead problems were discovered, right? So, and she will. So this event is at Darden, right? And she will lay out the history event where we are now, and her perspective, I think, will be complemented by Ruffner Page, who's actually a Darden alum but also leads a multinational in water infrastructure, and so he'll give us his perspective as to how he sees the water infrastructure challenge that we face in the United States, right? Since much of the infrastructure is not well maintained, right? So, and this is in part also related to the fact that we don't pay enough for water. And then Cale Yaffe will then also look at the legal aspect of water quality, water infrastructure, and the social aspect.
Yeah, and I was trying to get before at that it's World Water Day, March 22nd. So these events are around that day. And it's been an annual event for about 4 years now. So again, we're going to be giving away a gift card, so stay tuned. And Nancy.
Well, if I have time for one more question, do I, Ellen?
Yes.
Peter, I was just wondering how you thought the U.S. compared, how our use of water compared to the rest of the world. Are we smarter? Are we getting smarter, rather? Are we planning enough for the long term?
As we've seen with the water crisis in California, is that we are learning as we go, right? So we use lots of water, and on a per capita basis, probably more than in many other countries. But we have an ability to learn, right? So and people are very innovative in the water sphere, and you see that also in California, that yes, people are starting to think about new ways of addressing the problem. For example, water markets, which is what I do research on, also is that this, which is the ability to actually trade the right to use water without trading the land between different partners, right? So these are all new tools that are being with which people are experimenting, and this is also happening in the United States.
So we are coming up at the end of our discussion now, because we're going to need to go. But thank you, Dr. Peter DeBaer.
Yes.
He's a professor at Darden. He's a world water expert. And again, the events are March 15th through April 13th. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Great. And Nancy, how are you doing?
I'm putting in my my 5 seconds before you can me for the palate cleanser for the week, Ellen.
Go for it.
And
you have such little time.
Mine is just a word. I learned it this week. It's called, well, you probably know it, but anyway, it's called a guanciale. And the reason I like it is just because of the way it sounds. It sounds so funny, or it sounds like a sporty roadster that you would get your first car, your first Italian car. But apparently, as you probably know, it's some Italian pork sausage or Italian meat.
Yeah, I actually didn't know that. So mine, I was going to talk about leeks because I really recommend them on any kind of salmon, or they are so beautiful. But I also wanted to announce that my glimmer of hope of the week is that Iceland announced that they plan to be the first country in the world to require equal pay for women at a national level. So yay to the prime minister there. He said gender equality benefits all of us. So, and also I need to give the question. So the question is, go to the Facebook page at 94.7 WPVC, and if you're the first to message us the answer to this question, what, in a perverse way, Saudi Arabia is exporting what? So if you can give us the answer, this relates to water.
Ah, yeah, I remember.
Yes.
I'm doing it. I'm going.
Okay. So we'll see you next week, where we can guarantee we will be apropos of something.
Good idea.